Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
If white person sings along to rap song where there's the N-word, are they racist? Are Chinese people that open Chinese restaurants that serve westernized Chinese food guilty of appropriating their own culture? If you're half black and you grew up in the hood but you look 100% white, do you have white privilege? What about Asian privilege? I've noticed they're doing pretty well. They have very high enrollment rates at Ivy League schools and they tend to outperform everybody. And look at the top YouTube video of all time. It's Psy, a Korean guy. And the song isn't even in English. There's no way this could all be accomplished by simple merit. There must be some kind of Asian privilege. Should I, a Russian, be offended that homosexuals appropriated the bathhouse? I mean, this is a significant part of my heritage, which now stands for something completely different. Are skinny to average-sized women inherently microaggressing against fat girls? If race is a social construct, then is bone marrow racist?
You're wondering now what to do. Now you know this is the end. You're wondering how you will pay for the way you misbehave.
Up next, we're going to talk about Twitter's new safety council that cracks down on so-called harmful speech. They're wheeling and dealing to prevent hurt feelings. This week, Twitter announced the creation of a trust and safety council to ensure users, quote, feel safe expressing themselves. What? The council's comprised of over 40 mostly liberal organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League, GLAAD, and something called the Dangerous Speech Project, which sounds like the name of my Phish tribute band. While proponents say the council will help Twitter prevent harassment and bullying, critics argue it could be used to squash certain political viewpoints like mine and even censor free speech.
What really strikes me is the assault on free speech by the left. This is a huge change. When I was a kid, I'm not that old. Liberals were flaky and they were into macrobiotic food and all yoga and all this stuff. But they, in the end, they really kind of did support your right to say something they disagreed with. Now they don't. And that's where the conversation ends. You can't even have a conversation with someone who doesn't acknowledge your right to have a divergent view. That becomes fascism. That is actually a threat to America, for real. Mm-hmm. Like, all the other crap aside, that is the core of it.
Milo, what do you make of this safety council? I think it's directed at you.
No, it's literally all about me.
Yes, it is.
I'm why that's it happened. And you know how I know this? Yes. Is there's this crazy woman called Anita Sarkeesian from Feminist Frequency, this far-left, wacky video games critic who would never have been on there if it hadn't been for me, and me getting unverified because I got the wrong opinions on Twitter. They took my checkmark away. Can you believe that?
No.
It's like buying a business class ticket, and then you get on the plane, and they tell you to turn right. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is Orwellian, and it's terrifying. They've started to give ideological slaps on the wrist, these networks, and then you've got Facebook teaming up with Merkel in Germany to censor discussion about immigration. Perfectly reasonable, respectable mainstream opinions about the 1.5 million Muslims that are coming into Germany, and Facebook says, you know, Angela, you just tell us, and within 24 hours, we'll take it off the network. Yeah. This is scary stuff.
But we do have to remember, though, that Twitter is a business, okay? So their stock is down.
Yeah.
They've lost 2 million users recently.
Thank God.
And so what do you do when you're a business that's like, oh, we need to make more money? You look at the complaints, which are often, in this case, bullying and harassment, mm-hmm. and then you try to appease those people who are complaining and try to get more people to come in. So Twitter is not some, you know, model of morality. They are a business who's trying to make money, and this is their solution to their problem.
And if the people can't handle being on Twitter, don't be on Twitter. You know, go play an acoustic guitar at a coffee shop in Brooklyn or Portland and, like, cry into your tea or whatever. But just get off of it, because you know what? It's not that big of a deal that I'm called a horrible, horrible slut every day. To me, it's fine. It's like, all right, whatever, your profile avatars of a dog.
You're wondering now what to do. Now you know this is the end. You're wondering how
what I'd love to talk about is other things that prevent, you know, you from releasing work or stagnate our creativity. Because for me, you know, obviously there's, you know, censorship or self-censorship because of the status quo and because of what gets taken down these days and what people get worked up about. But I find there's something that's been holding me back even more lately, and it's self-censorship against basically stupidity. And I'll expand on that. People these days are willingly misinterpreting each other. They have a dialogue in their head, and if something does not fit in that dialogue or does fit in the dialogue, you gotta make a box for it. Like, you can't have like this fluid mind where things go in and out and you kind of agree, kind of disagree, where you weigh all of the different factors. No, people have this mind, and they need to, what you're saying needs to fit perfectly into their dialogue.
Oh, you're one of those blanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, then, I have to actually think about something for a moment. And people don't like to do that. So they force what you're saying to fit into their dialogue, even if it's not what you meant at all. And everyone knows what I'm talking about. If you have Twitter or Facebook or anything, you say a statement and then people are like, yeah, well, blah, 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 blah. And what they're saying has literally nothing to do with what you said, or they assume something completely elaborate and out of the ordinary from your very simple one-liner. And it's quite unfortunate because we need to learn to turn off our internal dialogue and not have this gag reflex to what people are saying, because that prevents us from actually listening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you know, I just posted an episode yesterday of my show, and the title was Just Say Milo Yiannopoulos and Watch What Happens. And I was on Free Talk Live on Saturday, and I wanted to talk about the experiences that he's been having going to these colleges and universities and doing his little confrontational tour, which I think is a great idea. And I think could have a lot of really positive benefits for the conversation of, you know, comfort versus freedom of speech, or comfort and safety versus exchange of ideas or actual learning. Which is, you know, a big part of learning is being made to feel uncomfortable or pushing through adversity. Those are growth experiences. And it sounds like there's a lot of people that he's encountering who just don't want to have them. Now, the reason why I bring this up is because I think this is more difficult. This problem that you're talking about, it rears its ugly head, in certain topics more than others. So we started talking about Milo. The conversation very, very quickly shifted to race. Like, the racial part of the whole Milo thing had a gravity that sucked the entire conversation to it. And then all of the callers, regardless of what side of the issue they were on or what their perspectives were, it was very, very hard, I think, for people to hear each other, to hear differences of opinions. This seems to be the case on Twitter. This seems to be the case on Facebook. This seems to be the case in these YouTube exchanges that we see. This certainly is the case on television. So is this the kind of, I use the word stupidity, just the shutting down of critical thought, the shutting down of empathy in the realm of these certain subjects?
Yeah. And we like to, you know, we're part of like this enlightened libertarian anarcho-capitalist free market, I guess, what would you call a movement? I don't know,
sure,
community.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And we tend to put ourselves on higher ground. We're on a pedestal. We think about stuff. We don't believe in what the government says all the time. We question educational systems. We blah, 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 blah. And yet, if I say, something, black people, discrimination or cops or violence, I'm a social justice warrior. I have triggered people who don't like social justice warriors. Therefore, if I ever even comprehend the possibility that there may be discrimination in some cases, I'm all of a sudden a big social justice warrior. I'm a traitor. And the opposite is true. And it's sad because the same people that are being triggered by that are the same people criticizing those who are triggered by a social injustice. It's very hypocritical. Nobody, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to talk about instances of racism and sexism and homophobia without being labeled a social justice warrior. You should be able to criticize the assumption of racism, sexism, and homophobia without being called a racist, sexist, or homophobic person, right? Why can we not reach some sort of nuanced conversation about these topics.
Yeah, and it does really come back to that "you're one of them" thing. It's a kind of comfort, and you know, I raised it as a challenge to. I think I was on another show with somebody who very much identifies with the alt-right neo-reactionary movement, and I said, you know, I was really confronted with this realization. I have these kind of prejudging patterns in certain cases for the sake of taking intellectual shortcuts. So the example that I gave him was there was a video that I wound up using in a show talking about what was going on in college campuses. And it was something called the Glenn Show. It was Glenn Lowry, who is a professor at some Ivy League school, and John McNaughton, who's a professor at another Ivy League school. I think the schools are Columbia and Brown, but I can't remember who belongs to which one. And they're both black, and the subject that they're discussing is Black Lives Matter. Now, this thing goes off in my head that says, I know exactly what they're going to say. And they blew my minds with what they actually said. But I have that prejudice, I guess. I mean, that's really what it is, that I could look at two people, Ivy League academics on the issue of Black Lives Matter, and you're both black. I think I know where this is going. And I was totally wrong.
It's an echo chamber. It is. And good for you for continuing to listen to them and give it a chance. Mm-hmm. But most people will just turn it off or assume, you know, make the assumption, listen to 5 minutes and then be like, oh yeah, of course, that's where they're going, turn it off.
Oh yeah. And that suggested videos column on YouTube is killing us.
It really is. Awful. It makes everything as a petri dish, and it's such a confirmation bias. And it, you know, people need to keep in mind that if you make a statement about one group of people, that doesn't necessarily mean you're endorsing another group of people.
Right.
Or if you make a statement about one gender, that doesn't mean you're endorsing the other gender. It just means you're making a statement about something, right?
Yeah.
But everything, you know, everything is a reaction now. And it, in some ways, it's always been that way. And it needs to be that way because we need a balance. But to be frank, it's becoming annoying. And I think creating more artistic verbalizations of commentary can actually maybe even safeguard that and put a filter on it. Because when you're presenting art that's a little bit ambiguous and a little bit up for your own interpretation, if you're going through the processes without being triggered by anything, maybe you'll realize some, you know, possible truths on your own without being, you know, nobody wants to have opinion shoved down their throat. And when you turn on a person who you already disagree with, you're just, you know, you're going to be predetermined to disagree with everything they're saying. But that's never true. I don't believe that there's single two people in the world that can't find something to agree on.
So do you feel like this all kind of grew out of our self-censorship conversation? Do you feel like there are topics that you don't want to touch because you're worried about what the response will be or what you'll have to deal with?
Yeah, it's not about response for me, because I find that the most negative responses that I've gotten to videos have actually gained me a lot of followers, which is interesting. You know, in the moment, you're kind of upset and pissed off, and then you look at your stats and you're like, oh, I actually gained loads of followers for this. The problem is people who are nuanced and do, have maybe opinions that aren't as on the extreme sides, they're not very vocal. You know, they don't get triggered and start writing mean comments to you. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, I never thought about that. Like, follow. And they kind of, you know, keep checking in and out. And they're not the diehard, opinionated people that you're going to hear over and over again. So there's a skewed reality online. There's an incredibly skewed reality online. So that's just anyone who ever puts anything out there. The people who don't like it are going to be the loudest. I don't care what you're doing. I don't care if you're a rapper, an artist, an author. Like, the people that hate you will be much more vocal. So that's just one thing. So that doesn't actually, prevent me from putting anything out. What does prevent me from putting new work out is this worth it? Is this actually going to change the dialogue? I have to weigh my time and my effort and my mental health and the result I anticipate in getting. And I recently had a whole day to myself, and I wrote this long dissertation about, I won't even mention what it was about because it'll start an angry rant in your comment section. But at the end of it, I realized that I don't have all the pieces. I don't actually fully believe my statements that I'm writing. And even if I did, who cares? Because this is such a niche issue. It's an issue that is only attributed to a certain demographic of people, which I can't relate to, and neither can the people who are criticizing them. And what's the point? So I have this like long time consumed piece of work that it's just going to be sitting there probably forever. But I learned a thing or two from it about my own ignorance. And in the long term, I'm sure it'll help me out in a lot of ways I didn't think it could.
Yeah, that externalization itself has tremendous benefits. I'm so curious, Julia, what was the topic?
Oh my God.
I'll edit it out if it's too much. If I don't think that the YouTube audience can take it, I'll edit it out. The podcast audience, they're very mature. They can handle anything, but.
Okay. Well, it was a topic about this vehement hatred for single mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things that are justified and a lot of things that are not considered. But at the end of the day, it boils down to you can't make the same argument. So like, let's say take single mothers, right? You can't take single mothers as a whole and make one argument for why they exist or what motivates them.
Indeed.
You have to look at it demographically. So there is most single mothers are under the poverty level. Now, how many of them were there before that or after that? What's their background? What's their socioeconomic circumstance? And those, all of those things are very specific, right? But even taking, there's a demographic of the poverty stricken single moms. And then there's the demographic of, I guess, middle income. And then there's like rich and there's a pyramid to it. And you can't be, intellectually honest if you merge that all into one. Okay. You can't. It has to be looked at from each demographic separately. Because different things need to be considered when judging or evaluating people's circumstances, depending on what socioeconomic status they are. And that's not just true for single mothers. That's true for a lot of different subjects and issues and people, right?
Yeah.
So, you can make the statement of, oh, well, they just want to collect welfare. Well, that only is true for women who are incredibly poor to begin with, because for a woman to be middle class with a good job, to opt into being a single mother and reduce her standard of living because of that child, that is not a motivation. It's only motivation for a specific class of women who doing that makes their standard of living a little bit higher, right?
Somebody listening to this right now feels uncomfortable, and I think that's a great thing, because what you're encouraging them to do is break out of this same comfort trap that I fell into with Glenn Lowry and John McNaughton and the Black Lives Matter Ivy League college professor thing, where, oh, I get what this is. Oh, these are people who are motivated by this. Done. Okay. Pack that up and move on. And, having this ability, or it's not a real ability, it's a trick that people play on themselves, mm-hmm. to not have to deal with the discomfort of the unknown. So that's why we see labels slapped to these things. And you're right. And that was when I first started hearing the single moms issue come up, whenever it was like 2013, 2014, in more public forums, I said, wow, there's a lot more to unpack there than what's being presented.
And people to say that the single moms are motivated in England by the same things that motivate them in Canada is complete crap. Because in Canada, single moms do not collect more welfare than anyone else. In Canada, you don't even have single mom welfare. If you're a single mom, you don't get a special welfare. You will get child benefit. Everybody gets child. Anyone with a child that earns less than $60,000 a year, I think, gets child benefit. Single dad, single mom, family, two married people that are together, a common law marriage, everybody gets child benefit. So there is no overt motivation to become a single mom all of a sudden. And in fact, I know a single mom who had to go beg for food on the street because she wasn't getting enough, or she couldn't get more for herself and her baby. She was a teen mom. Like, it's not in Canada, women do not go, oh yeah, I'm going to sit on government welfare and, have a kid. In England, way different. I know people in England who have a very comfy life. because they are a single mom. They have a very nice home and a nice neighborhood because they're a single mom. So you can't, like, do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, it's absolutely.
Yeah, you cannot make a blanket statement about the condition and motivation of all women who have a child without a man.
Yeah,
right?
I don't like it when it's pinned to race, because the situation in the United States sounds similar to what you're describing in England. I was introduced to the welfare system as a young, naive liberal, I think in maybe late 90s, when I heard two women talking in a video store, and one of them said to the other, "I'm going to keep having kids until the state buys me a house."
Holy moly.
My jaw dropped. I couldn't believe it, you know?
Holy so moly.
That's...
I feel bad for her children. Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely.
And can I just say, I guess we're winding this topic down. At the end of the day, the children are the ones being punished.
Yeah.
And no matter the circumstance, whether the woman did it for reasons you just mentioned, I'm very sorry for her children to have such a mother, or whether, you know, it takes two. A guy has to leave the woman for her to be a single mom. I feel just as bad for those people who, you know, they fall deeply in love, or they're silly, and then the man leaves because he can. And if he's poor, you can't make anybody pay money they don't have. So the mom gets the short end of the stick. And at the end of the day, in that circumstance, the child suffers as well. And I don't know. I don't have a solution for it, but I think hating an entire class of people when the circumstances differ from person to person, from country to country, from demographic to demographic is incredibly sad.
Yeah. I mean, solutions aside, the path to a solution to any problem starts with making an effort to understand it. So it sounds like that's what you're trying to provide, but this whole topic that this specific issue grew out of was self-censorship and a kind of frustration after observing what's out there and how things get responded to. Let me ask you this, unless there's anything else you want to say on that, because it kind of leads me to another question.
Yeah, I'll say one last thing. The overall problem, like if you want to be quite general and get to the root of what we're talking about, is lazy, entitled people. Mm-hmm. And those kind of people exist in, you know, both genders and in all races. And unfortunately, the state rewards those people. You know, there's a lot of people on workers' comp or work, you know, if you don't have a job, you'll sit on job welfare, employment insurance, right? Unemployment insurance, et cetera. This is an issue of lazy people being rewarded. Mm-hmm. That's the issue. And I don't know how to solve that issue. Get rid of the state. I think that solves a lot of issues, not just that one.
Yeah, I agree with that. So back to self-censorship and the related frustrations. Can I ask why you made one of your recent videos? I forget how many questions it was. It was either 13 or 14 questions for social justice warriors. What prompted you to put that together and put it out? And what were you hoping for as a response, if anything?
I wanted to do something fun and funny. And when I go to work, I work with my sister, and we get like lulls, you know, busy, not busy, busy, not busy. So we just like derp around and joke and talk about all sorts of things. So I just started, I guess, firing off these like questions like, oh, Alona, do you think if Chinese people make westernized Chinese food, they're appropriating their own culture? And it was just fun. And I ended up just writing a bunch of them down and making a video. Why not? And it was an easy video to do. And it was topical. And I thought it would get more views, to be honest, because a lot of the social justice warrior videos on YouTube are like getting loads of views. But I think it's also within this circle of self-feeding circle. There's a lot of big YouTube stars that solely focus on anti-feminism and social justice warriors. So I think they kind of circle the videos around.
It's a crowded
kind
market
of left
too.
Field. Yeah. But yeah, it was just fun. You know, that was just a fun video for me. And I think it opens up a lot of questions. Like, are people really racist these days? Like what does racism really mean? Like, what does it take for someone to actually be racist? What does it take for someone to actually be sexist or homophobic? And joking about it is a good way to do it without offending most normal, reasonable people. You're still going to offend some people, but yeah. I had a very good response to that video, so I can't complain.
Do you find that there's anything else creating limitations on being able to express yourself to the fullest, aside from what we just described or what we just talked about?
Yeah. This is where doing it through an artistic format really helps, because there's more leeway for people to say the things they want to say with music or visual arts or video arts. But outright, like, I usually censor myself. I censor myself a lot on Twitter. Even before I knew Twitter was starting to shadow ban people, because it's not a platform where you can elaborate on what you meant well.
Right.
And a lot of the time I'll tweet things that aren't even that outrageous, and I'll get these responses that I don't understand where they're coming from. And then I really have to sit there and think, well, I guess without the framework of the context I'm coming from, you could interpret it that way. So, yeah, the interpretational nature of statements is what censors me quite often.
So do you see that as like a kind of potential time sink for you? Like you're going to get sucked into explaining yourself to a bunch of angry people?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Just the other day, you know, someone was almost lecturing me about even still having a Twitter account. He's like, it's a time suck. He's gradually eliminated all social media from his life because he's trying to focus right now. I love Twitter, but it is a time sink because you'll say something and someone will willingly misinterpret you. And then do you want to justify yourself? Do you want to explain yourself? Do you want to attempt to explain yourself? I had the other day, we were talking about whether catcalling is violence, whether threats are violence. And I basically said, you know, threats are tricky. You need to really isolate off the cuff comments that are empty in nature to real legitimate threats with a potential to be followed through on. And that's a tricky thing to do. And the person responded like, yeah, because it would be better if all threats were followed through on, right?
Whoa.
What?
Yeah, that's weird.
And at that point, I'm just like, end thread. Like, you're insane.
What do you think it is? Because I don't spend a lot of time on that world. If you're the first one to leave, you lose. Is that how it works?
Hell no. If you're the first one to leave, it means you got a life.
Okay. I mean, that's what it seems like it would be. I just don't know in that culture, like, why these things are... I just haven't really participated much in that kind of dialogue. And I definitely see the limitations that you're talking about with Twitter. But what are people thinking when they just keep going with this stuff? Or they start talking to why would you talk to a stranger with whom you disagree in that format? What could you ever expect to accomplish? I don't know.
It's, you know, I've had some discourse on Twitter where it was reasonable. And at the end, we understand each other. And the limitation of the short phrasing can actually aid that when you assume the two people are reasonable, because you're not blabbering on. You're forced to really put your argument in the simplest terms, in the shortest sentence structure you can possibly come up with. So that could help, but that's very rare, you know. Very, very, very rare. And I had that happen with a guy who made a response video to my men's rights movement video, where he assumed that Julie Borowski and I were justifying women hitting men, which was not the case. And I elaborated on my thought process. For example, I told him via Twitter, I believe in gun rights. I believe in property rights. That doesn't mean that I think it's okay for a person to shoot a teenager who broke into their house in the face. Okay? Right. It's common sense. Just like I believe in individual responsibility, I believe in the non-aggression principle, but that doesn't mean I believe that someone twice as big as someone else should physically retaliate in a way that would hurt them 15 times worse than they could have hurt them, even though they initiated it. It's about common sense.
Right. And it sounds like a lot of these concerns that you have about Twitter translate to your video work. Like a lot of your videos are to the point. They're short. You're not being vague in any way. They're carefully and well written.
Yeah. You think you're being clear.
Yeah.
I write these things with mindfully because I know people get triggered, and you think you're being as clear as you possibly can. And then people still misinterpret you. You know, you can say, I love lemons. Oh, lemons are the most delicious thing ever. And then people be like, oh, why do you hate limes so much?
Yeah.
Like, exactly. What?
So what's your solution, or what kind of solutions have you contemplated to this? Because you don't want to wind up having, you know, all of this creative flow bottlenecked by other people's stupidity was the word that you used, right?
Yeah. My short-term solution was to be more trolly. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And confuse people even more, like just to throw them off. Because my real audience, the people that I respect, never misinterpret me. Never. I even have severe disagreements with individuals in both the anarchist space, both the Bitcoin space. And we still follow each other. We still respect each other. We still like each other overall. But, you know, we disagree on certain points. That's the people that I should value as my audience. And we forget, like I said, the angry voices are always the loudest. So the only advice I can give, and I give this advice to myself over and over again because I don't follow it, just don't care. The people that don't understand what you're doing or trying to say, they're not going to understand it. In any way you phrase it, they're just not going to understand it. They have their own agenda. They have their own dialogue. Their worldview is shaped usually by feelings of victimhood. And you're not going to change them. And at the end of the day, those are the people who have sad lives. Because, you know, my mom put it plainly. My mom said, oh, I was looking at some of your videos and people write very long comments. Don't these people have families or significant others or jobs? Like, how do they find the time to do this? I have never written a comment on a video. I'm like, Mom, do you understand how smart you are?
Do you spend a lot of time, proportional to the whole process, do you spend a lot of time reading comments? Like, would you, if you made a video that was just like, put some numbers to it, it was 10 minutes long, would you invest a half an hour to an hour reading what people write about it?
As a woman, I go through severe emotional and lulls and dips and heights and lows. So I'll go for months not even looking at a comment or responding to a single person. And then I'll have that day where I feel awful and emotional and hormonal. And I'll just like, I'll waste the entire day reading comments or responding to someone or writing something. And often what I do now is, I'll write this whole response clarifying myself, and then I won't post it. I'll save it.
Yeah.
I'll save it to my little library, and I'll have it there for personal reflection, and I'll delete, like, I won't actually respond. So I think that's helpful, because that makes you realize that in the heat of the moment, you caring about something is not objectively, just because you care about something in the heat of the moment doesn't make it objectively important, right? as soon as your like little hormonal wave passes, and guys go through this too. Like guys get like really, you know, both guys and girls get angry about things. And we should talk about that, anger as a fuel for creative process, because actually, specifically in men, it's been documented to be a great motivation fuel in many instances, specifically for men. And that's just because of the way that the male brain works better in, like, more cohesively with high testosterone levels. When women get all amped up and angry and testosterone-y, I think their brain reacts to it a little bit differently.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was what prompted me to ask the question about the SJW video, to see if it was something that was anger-driven out of a lot of the frustrations that you've already talked about. But it sounds like it was more for fun.
That one was more fun. I didn't have too much anger about that video. It was just way more fun for me. But I definitely have had projects that are like purely driven by rage.
For me, like, anger is the appearing angry is appearing to be out of control, at least in how I perceive myself. That could be completely subjective, but
you gotta channel it.
Okay. Yeah. And there's certainly ways to do that. And I think I have done that, but I don't want videos of me on the internet, like, yelling and being angry.
Yeah.
Unless they're funny.
Someone comes to mind. There's someone who's been making a series of videos that are very angry and very negative. And I find myself repulsed by them. Even if I don't disagree with what the person's saying, I'm repulsed by that approach.
Yeah. And it's just not for me. I don't like the way I look in that kind of setting. Unless I'm in on the joke. unless this is theatrical anger. That's just not a way that I want to present myself.
I have a problem. I'm Russian. So a lot of people interpret me as angry when I'm just being passionate or critical. Like, I make really scowly faces, but like, I'm not angry, guys. I'm just Russian. Like, in my culture, it's really normal.
I'm just Russian.
Yeah.
So do you think, moving from there, the critiques or the feedback that we get from others, constructive or otherwise, do you think you've developed a constructive self-critique process for the work you do or the things that you're working on?
Yeah, for sure. I used to really, again, I get caught up in reactions, right? I get caught up, someone says something and I'm like, oh my God. And I start writing something. And now I've promised myself to procrastinate and take a step back, because something, and it was a learning process, because I have an abortion video and it explores the concept of abortion from a moral standpoint. Mm. I wrote the article that was the basis for that video 2 years prior to the video. And I churned that article into a video script like a year before I released the video, because I wanted to really sit on that issue, because my journey on having an opinion on abortion is so long. You know, it comes from a completely different view from when I was a teenager to, you know, in between that now and then to now. So I really wanted to make sure that I'm not going to put this out and be like, oh, I don't believe in this anymore. So with very important subjects like that, with life or death subjects like that, I've stepped back and waited. And I think it's important to do that for other subjects as well, maybe ones that aren't as important or vital, because anything you put out into the world should be thoughtful. And that's the problem. People will put something out there without thinking about it, without considering any opposing views. And sometimes it ends up haunting them.
And how do you evaluate it? Is it as simple as just like reading it and saying, I still stand by this? Or are you, you know, going through what you've written? I mean, what happens to me is like, I think I'll get an idea and it'll just kind of blurt out in a cluster of words that goes from point A to point B, but then like each line needs to be refined and maybe even expanded. Like, okay, I get what I'm trying to do with line 7. You know, I really don't even write things out like this too often. But if I made it 4 or 5 lines, everybody else would certainly understand what this is about too.
But then it's long-winded or boring or not as creative, not as poetic. It's the balance, right? And that goes back to the question of, should you care about those people that aren't going to get it with the one line?
Yeah, no, I've always liked the idea of, you know, leaving things open for interpretation, you know, and not doing anything that suggests I have all the answers. I certainly don't think that. My whole presentation is about looking for answers and going to people that I think might have more than me on certain subjects, and then reporting back to the people who might need some of the answers that I have or that I've found. So open to interpretation is a really important thing, especially with video production, especially when it has a kind of, you know, stylistic component to it. Something like you did with The Shift. It has to, I don't want to say conform, but there are other considerations, right, for what's being presented. Really, actually, besides just, is every spoken line as clear as it can possibly be for everybody?
That, yeah, because I can change the meaning of that line with the image I use.
Yeah.
Right? Or if that image is, you know, triggers someone for some reason I could have never anticipated, that meaning of that line is completely different now, which, again, is the reason why I encourage people to maybe go into a more artistic direction, because it's almost a safeguard for yourself.
Right. Yeah, I think however it's presented, being able to explain to yourself or somebody else why you did something a certain way, and being able to actually explain your stance on the things that were open to interpretation after the fact, whether you do it or not, just being able to say, okay, I know why I'm doing this and I know exactly what I'm trying to say. I could say it in 5 lines, but I'm going to say it in 1. And if I had to say it in 5 or explain it later to somebody in 5, these would be those 5 lines. So it's not, right, you know, an excuse to be lazy.
And it also, instead of directly challenging people, it maybe makes them self-reflect. Like, oh, does she mean this? And if she does, do I agree? And why? Like, I think putting something in a humorous way or in an artistic way stimulates thought better than just like a direct approach.
Too proper for the black kids, too black for the Mexicans, too square to be a hood nigga. What's normal anyway? Too opinionated for the pacifist, too out of touch to be in style, too broke for the rich kids. I don't know what normal is. What's normal anyway? What's normal anyway? I mean, what's normal anyway? What's normal anyway? What's normal anyway? I'm in a crowd and I feel alone. I look around and I feel alone. I never feel like I belong. I wanna feel like I belong. And I feel alone. I never feel like I belong. I wanna feel like I belong. Too immoral for the Christians, but too moral for the cutthroat. Too far out for the in crowd. What's normal anyway? Too involved in my own life. Spend time with my family. Too concerned about what others think. What's normal anyway? What's normal anyway? What's normal anyway? I mean, what's normal anyway? What's normal anyway? What's normal anyway? In the crowd and I feel alone. Look around and I feel alone.